episode 144 of Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry. Special shout out to all our friends from the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry Facebook group. We love having you as part of our group, and we hope you stay for a long time. With me today, my friend, Barry Rose. Barry, how are you doing today?
I'm doing good. With you today, Jeff. It's like we're the two
sometimes
best.
Sometimes you are with, you know.
Sometimes I am. It's been a while. I think the last time the last time I saw you in person, I believe, was November. And I'm hopeful that within the next 5 years, we can actually get together again and hang out. Yeah, it would be nice, you know.
So on today's episode, we are going to be talking about a number of different things. We'll be continuing our top 10 restaurants that we left off with the last week. We will be discussing I'll Be Gone in the Dark, the first episode, Barry. I will be discussing some movies that I watched recently. And we will be looking at the new Netflix series, Unsolved Mysteries. Barry and I will be talking about the first two episodes that were especially well done, Barry. And finally, just because I think if anyone listens to this show on even a semi-regular basis, I think we've established that Barry Rose is a bit of a foodie. Would you say that's fair, Bear?
Yeah, I'd say that's fair. Okay. It's a hobby, Jeff. It's a hobby.
No. We all love food. Yeah. And, I myself love a good restaurant. And I'm going to mention one that I went to this weekend with my wife. But what I really wanted to tell Barry about is the way that Barry feels about food, I feel about music and songs. So Barry, this weekend, as my wife and I are driving around, I noticed that on SiriusXM's 70s channel, they're doing the top 700 of the 70s. Barry, are you ready to go?
Are we doing
the
top
70s? No, I wouldn't do that to you, Barry. The rib.
I was ready just to fucking throw down the microphone on the counter and storm off.
What I will tell you is, okay, Barry, I want you to close your eyes for a second and think, 700 songs, the top 700 songs of the 70s. Okay. Now they specify that these songs are voted on by the listeners of this channel. Okay. Barry, at number 692, I believe, is If You Don't Know Me By Now by Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes. Are there 690 songs better than that song by Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes?
No, so what this isn't rock and roll, it's just any genre of music.
It's just a top 40 songs from the 70s. It's on
top 40.
It's
on, got it. Okay.
It's currently being for the, you know, 4th of July weekend. And when I first heard that, I said, this is what's number 692. How can there be over 690 songs that are better than, which is it's a great friggin' R&B song. And I said, I got to bring this up on the show. And just to annoy Barry. So there you go, Barry. I just thought I'd annoy
you. I'm annoyed. There you go. Yeah, exactly. It works.
Says just for, for Harold, Strassler, 200 of the songs are by the Cars. So among other things that I want to mention that we're going to talk about on the show, for the very first time, I think, in 140 plus episodes, Barry, our match of the week will feature the original Sheik. How have we managed to go? I mean, not that he's like, you know, the dynamite kid in the ring here, but we've gone 140 plus episodes and we have never discussed a match involving the man Ed Farhat.
Yeah, how is that possible, too?
And
the amazing
know.
Thing with this match, Jeff, this match goes longer than 6 minutes, which for the Sheik also finding a match that's rare.
And I got to tell you, I don't know how you feel about it. I thought it was a damn entertaining match. Maybe not because of Ed. But he and Abdullah the Butcher facing off in the All Japan Finals in 1979 against the Funk Brothers. It's a hell of an entertaining match. I got to be honest with you.
No, I fully agree too. This is actually good. This was a big deal when this match took place, and then years later. And I know that when Baba released a lot of the DVDs, those professional looking DVDs with like crystal clear pictures and everything, this was something that was on those DVDs because somebody sent it to me years ago. And it just, this is a really, really, are we jumping into this match right now? Or
well,
are we
let's talk
teasing?
About a couple things real quick where we'll tease.
Okay.
Let's talk about a couple things. First of all, unfortunately this week we found out that we lost Killer Tim Brooks. So we raise an adult beverage to his memory. I asked you before we started, Barry, tell us about any time that, that Tim Brooks might've spent in the state of Florida versus CWF.
Yeah, it was a 72 or 73. I forget exactly which year. He didn't make much of an impression. He was in, it was only a couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks. I think it was kind of a missed opportunity with Killer Tim Brooks. He was friends with a lot of the guys too, like Blackjack Mulligan was a friend of his. Dusty Rhodes, Rocky Johnson, a lot of the guys that had spent time in Texas were all good friends with Tim Brooks, but for whatever reason, didn't really have much of an impact in the state of Florida. I can tell you, I saw photos of him 2 weeks ago. I believe they gave him an award. I think it was the Wrestling Hall of Fame that's based out in Wichita Falls, Texas. And he looked terrible. I mean, obviously, he was dying of cancer, and he's had cancer the last couple of years, and he was gone just a week or two later. But he really looked bad. And I reached out to our old friend, Nick Massey. Nick, actually, who co-authored the great Scott Casey book that you and I have both read. He also was working with Killer Tim Brooks on his life story. So I believe it's in the can. It'll be published over the next few months. But I reached out to Nick, and I was trying to, Nick, have you seen this latest photo of Tim? And what's the prognosis? And he said, it's not good. It'll be any time. So rest in peace, Killer Tim Brooks. He was a wrestling lifer. He was a guy, I think, that lived and breathed professional wrestling, wrestled as long as he could, was in a lot of promotions as long as he could. And then at the end of his career, became a trainer, had a wrestling school, as a lot of the guys do. But Jeff, what do you think, if I say to you, Killer Tim Brooks, what's the first thing that pops into your head?
I would say his stint in Detroit. I know he had a good run there. I know he was up in Portland. If I don't mention that, I'll get a text from Kevin Orcutt. But he wasn't there. I think he had a different name. It wasn't Killer Tim Brooks. Can you remember what the name was? Or Lou, can you text us? I know he was under a different, it was like Bruiser Brooks or something like that. But yeah, a guy,
you know,
that
what?
Worked.
You just jogged a memory right there. In the Mid-Atlantic area, he came in as the cousin of Blackjack.
Bad News Brooks. Thank you, Lou.
Bad News Brooks. But Lou, what name did he use in the Mid-Atlantic area? They
Crazy
brought him
Lou
in. The,
Mulligan.
That's it, right?
Thank you, Lou.
The cousin of Blackjack Mulligan, and he was around. For some reason, when I think of Killer Tim Brooks, I think of his time in Georgia and his association with Larry Zbyszko and the national heavyweight title. Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, and I know his son is very active on social media. You know, he posted a lot of stuff about his dad. So we're very sorry for your loss. And again, we raise an adult beverage to the memory of Tim Brooks. So also want to mention, Barry, I had a chance. I know you said you had not seen it. Want to give a very quick high recommendation to the movie Ford versus Ferrari with Matt Damon and Christian Bale. Had a chance to watch this last week. Really, really good movie about the competition that resulted at the Le Mans, the 24 Hours of Le Mans in the mid-60s as Ferrari really kind of shit on Ford, and how Henry Ford II basically created this team to come up with the Ford Mustang and then the Shelby Mustang. And I got to tell you, I'm not one of those guys that you would call a gearhead. I don't know if you are, Barry, but this movie was very, very well acted. And I give it a good recommendation. If you get a chance, you need to check it out.
Yeah. So this movie, when it came out, I want to say last November, which I think is great, too. That's something that we don't really talk about. Remember in the old days, Jeff, a movie would come out and you had to wait a year until it made its way on HBO. It was a full year. Now, within like 6 or 7 months, it's like streaming somewhere. You don't have to pay anything additional for it. It's fantastic. But I went and saw a movie when I was out in Los Angeles, and they were already advertising this movie. And in the Cinerama Dome in Los Angeles, they had a whole display of the costumes and the outfits that I guess Christian Bale and Matt Damon had worn in the film. So I was interested. But now that you've said it, you really gave this a really high recommendation. And then I looked last night on my cable box, and the ratings for this movie, I guess it's Rotten Tomatoes. It was like a 92 and a 98, which would make that one of the highest rated movies that I can recall. So this, I think, just jumped to the top of my list. As you said, I'm not a gearhead at all, but apparently this movie transcends that. So I'm kind of excited about that.
Yeah, and I got to tell you, both guys as actors always do interesting work. You know, they don't pigeonhole themselves. And, you know, because Matt Damon's plays Carroll Shelby, the famous car designer, and he talks with this Texas twang and stuff like that. And I just find that these guys don't pigeonhole themselves to one or two roles. And I think that's always very interesting work. Okay, Barry, speaking of really interesting movies, we've had a chance to see HBO at the time of this recording, They would come out with the first episode. By the time this show comes out on Tuesday, the second one will have come out. Sunday nights, I want to say it's 10 o'clock. I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which, of course, is about the Golden State Killer and everything that came out about that case. What'd you think of the first episode, Bear?
It was very good. It's right up our alley, and it's something that I think you and I were both looking forward to watching. And, you know, I knew who the author was. I knew about her husband, obviously, is Patton Oswalt. And I knew that she had worked on this for years, but I didn't really understand the depths of how this really had taken over so much of her life, really from, you know, start to finish. I really enjoyed it. I think the first episode, as a lot of first episodes are, is really setting up what we're going to be seeing in the coming weeks. But I was riveted. I sat there for that full hour, and she was so, I didn't really know much about it. It was Michelle McNamara, right? Was her
yes,
name?
Yes, yes.
She's so engaging. I guess that's the word I'm looking for. As I sat there and I just listened to her talk, I just was completely just captivated, just listening to her and the passion in her voice. And there were some things revealed that I guess either escaped me or didn't have as much of an impact. But some of this stuff that the Golden State Killer did is, you know, look, obviously this guy was, you know, just one of the worst human beings ever. But some of this stuff he did to these teenagers, just as, you know, I sat there and I was disturbed by it, which, you know, I guess anybody in their right mind should be. So I have a new hatred for the Golden State Killer, deeper than my previous hatred.
Yeah. Go ahead.
But a lot of respect for Michelle McNamara. And I really want to see, because we obviously know where this is going, but I have a feeling we're going to get something that we don't already know. I think something is going to be revealed, or there's going to be some sort of great surprise for us here. And I'm actually really excited about that.
Well, what I was going to say was, this past week, I believe he was in court entering pleas. His name is Joseph DeAngelo. And he was, I like to say, he was working what they call the old crotchety man angle, which was so famously done by Bill Cosby at his sentencing phase, where, you know, yeah, it was very, and who's the Harvey Weinstein. Yeah. It's like all of a sudden they need the walker and all that kind of stuff. But no, I actually had my wife sit down and watch it, and she was a little confused because there was so much backstory about Michelle McNamara, right, as opposed to getting to the root of the case and stuff like that. But I had to tell her, you know, this is how this whole storyline started. But you're right. You know, what comes out, that the fact that this guy would not only commit these heinous crimes, these rapes, and these, you know, eventually end up leading into murder and stuff like that, but for the ones that he raped, that he would call them back and, you know, and say, I'm coming back. You know, you're going to see me. And I can't even imagine a woman that's been through that has to deal with, you know, of course, at this point, we're talking in the 70s and 80s, there was no caller ID. You know, now you see an unknown number or a number you don't recognize, you just don't bother to pick the damn phone up. But to have people pick up their phone and have to be subjected to that is, oh my God. And it's rather unfortunate that the just desserts that this guy really deserve, he's not going to get to, because I'm sure, based on the helpless old man routine that he was working, you know, he probably doesn't have much longer, but at least if he dies, he's going to die in prison.
Yeah, he's a real fucking piece of shit. And it's, as I watched this and, you know, was talking about how I guess he had raped several 15-year-old girls and their lives were ruined. And then they interviewed this one woman, and I don't remember if she was one of the 15-year-old girls or not, but this woman was clearly, decades later and years later, was still emotionally just completely a wreck. So, you know, it isn't like, you know, I think we've become so desensitized in some ways that, you know, the Golden State Killer has raped, and I don't know what the number is, but I'll say 30 women.
Yeah, without something knowing, like that.
Yeah, and we look at it as a number, and then, you know, when you stop and you think that these women essentially, for the most part, have probably been destroyed, that there is no recovery for something like this, and then their families are destroyed. It's exactly, just fucking horrific.
The collateral damage that happens along with it, you know?
It's terrible, just terrible. So I hope the guy, you know, look, at this stage, is anybody, obviously nobody fell for Cosby, nobody fell for Harvey Weinstein. Hopefully nobody fucking falls for this guy either. And I don't see it happening. And I know in California, it's not a death penalty state, but, you know, maybe being released in general population might be the greatest.
Accidentally.
Yeah, exactly. Right. It was an accident he hung himself. Exactly. maybe something like that should be the greatest punishment this guy could get.
Yeah. So highly recommend that. HBO Sunday night, I'll Be Gone in the Dark. Highest recommendation by Breaking Kayfabe on that. Oh, one real quick, another real quick movie issue that I'm just going to throw at you. This is unannounced.
Uh-oh.
So, yeah, I know you love when I do that.
I do.
So the other night, my wife and I were sitting watching TV, and one of the channels was running a marathon of the Bourne movies, Bourne Identity, Bourne Ultimatum. Why can't I think of the last one? It wasn't the Bourne Legacy. Lou will pipe in, I know. But anyway, it was the ones with Matt Damon. And so these came out around 2005-ish, which happened to be about the time that Daniel Craig took over as Lou says Bourne Free. No, that was about something else, Lou. So it came out about the same time Daniel Craig became James Bond. So my question to you, Barry, as a film fan, as you look at, and Matt Damon did one other Bourne film, which was called Jason Bourne, which is quite honestly of the four films that he did is kind of the least of the four. I think most people would agree with that. And Daniel Craig's movies, you had Casino Royale, which was excellent. You had Quantum of Solace, which got very mixed reviews. Then you had Skyfall, which got very high reviews. And then you had Spectre, which was probably third of the four. So do you think at some point the Jason Bourne movie series surpassed James Bond?
So we're talking about just for overall.
I'm just talking about the Daniel Craig movies.
Right. I think. So I think with James Bond, and this is going to be tough for you to hear because you're a huge James Bond fan.
Absolutely.
I think a lot. Look, James Bond was definitely our deal in the 60s and 70s and then to some degree maybe in the 80s. But I think a lot of the James Bond stuff, I don't want to say has gotten a little stale, but maybe it has gotten a little stale. And it does seem that movies like the Bourne series and even the Mission Impossible series with Tom Cruise, that it just seems like they're a little more current in a sense. So I know that is Daniel Craig has got one more movie and that's
yes.
it. Is that correct?
Yes.
So maybe they do go in a more current direction. I know they're not still doing it like Roger Moore is James Bond. So I know that there's been a lot of changes, but it just seems a little more dated in some ways. Who is the new James Bond, by the way? Did they ever figure it out?
No, they haven't figured it out. There's still like, here are 20 guys that are going to be possibly James Bond. And, you know, there's all kind of different, supposition and stuff like that. But I just, I think that's very fair. I think when Sean Connery and Roger Moore was doing it, I don't think there was anything that was near that level as far as an action film. And I forgot about you. You're absolutely right about the Mission Impossible series, because as far as just as pure action films, the way that James Bond is intended, now all of a sudden, the Daniel Craig lineage of James Bond has to compete with Jason Bourne. He has to compete with Ethan Hunt, I think is the character's name in Mission Impossible. So it makes it, it might make it look like it's not a standalone the way that it was like in the 60s and maybe into the early 70s. So I just thought it was, a topic of fair discussion.
Oh, it is. Absolutely.
So let's see. So I tell you what, Barry, why don't we now go to December 13th, 1979, we are at the finals of the All Japan Tag Team Tournament, and we're going to post a link to this. And just for the uninitiated, the match does not start at the very beginning of the clip. What you have is they're introducing the teams for the tournament. So you're going to see like Giant Baba and Jumbo Tsuruta. Barry got us a little Tsuruta fix there, along with some of the other teams. And I think maybe they show a few highlights, but then what you get to is you get to the finals, which are Terry and Dory Funk, the bearded Dory Funk, taking on the original Sheik Ed Farhat and Abdullah the Butcher. Barry, you've had a chance to watch this now. Tell us what you thought.
Yeah, and this was at a period, too, when the Funks had just kind of wrapped up a fantastic stint in the state of Florida. This was Terry Funk, who was the Florida heavyweight champion. Lost the title to Manny Fernandez. And this was also when Terry had cornrows. If you ever see those photos.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah, exactly. And Dory was in as well. And this was also when Terry had cost Dusty Rhodes the NWA World's Heavyweight title by breaking his arm. So they wound up in Japan. And hey, this is a really good match. And it's obviously you're not going to get a lot of wrestling here, based off of Abdullah and the Sheik. But it's very exciting. There's at no point is this match boring at all. I don't know if you noticed, but Jim Barnett in the first row, he's in the front row. As I'm looking, I'm going, who is that? who is that old lady right there? And it was Jim. it was like I couldn't figure. I'm squinting my eyes. I'm like, fuck, it's Jim Barnett. Jim Barnett's there. And there's a couple of things here. Dory does a suplex on Abdullah the Butcher. And in my head, I'm going, so how many times have we seen Abdullah get suplexed?
And let me just say, this is not a morbidly obese Abdullah the Butcher. This is a fat, overweight Abdullah the Butcher. Because he clearly weighs less than he did like a few years later.
Oh, he was. At this stage, Abdullah should have been a bigger star. And I know he was a big star in professional wrestling, but in his prime, which I think would have been the 70s, by the 80s, he put on a lot of weight and slowed down. You remember that thing where Bruiser Brody would go chasing after Abdullah?
Yeah.
And Brody would have to walk sideways because in order to not catch him, because Abdullah couldn't move. But Abdullah in the 70s, there's a match that's out there. And Jeff, maybe we should look at this at some point. It is Abdullah the Butcher versus Pepper Gomez, and it's from Tampa, 1975, and Abdullah he's taking bump after bump after bump. You know, his legs are up in the air as he's taking these bumps. So he certainly wasn't the same guy with the mud flaps that he had in the 80s. Abdullah was a tremendous worker in his prime. So he looks great here. But Dory doing a suplex on Abdullah, and Abdullah obviously had to help himself get in the air. This wasn't Dory's incredible strength. So a lot of credit to Abdullah at that stage, too. Everybody, though, what I like about this match, everybody's got their working shoes on. And
absolutely.
Even the Sheik. You know, we've seen the Sheik, and certainly the Sheik was a gimmick. He was a guy with the pencil and behind the ref's back, which he did in every match. But even here, he looks a little lighter. He's actually moving around the ring, making it interesting. Lots of gimmicks in this match. The Sheik's got a pencil. Abdullah's got a fork that he's using on Terry's ear, his head, his hand, his arm.
And Terry blades his hand.
Oh, yeah. And this is something I never knew. When your hand gets stabbed with a fork, it goes into convulsions.
My wife is a hand therapist, can absolutely verify this.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Terry's there getting stabbed. And just like guys do, like when they get like hit in the throat in professional wrestling, Terry goes into convulsions. It's amazing.
It's a seizure.
Yeah, exactly. Everybody's bleeding in this match. It's what you think it is, but it's a lot better than what you think it is.
And Barry, the fact that the Sheik is the one that takes the fall, I think we can count on one hand the amount of times he did a clean job during the decade of the 70s.
You know, for the life of me, I can't think of how many clean jobs he did. He had that run in Toronto, which I think lasted several years, where he had a main event run where he was undefeated. Undefeated meaning he had never taken a pinfall or submission. He had lost by disqualification. But, you know, I think Detroit was the same thing. The Sheik wasn't doing a lot of jobs. And even in the state of Florida, when we saw the Sheik, it was always some sort of screw job at the end. I would be really curious, and we probably need to reach out to some sort of Detroit expert and figure out how many clean jobs the Sheik has done in his career.
Yeah. And then there's a post-match schmaz where the Sheik throws fire at Abby. And then there's a crazy spot where Abby is covered with the towels by the Japanese guys. He's being led back to the dressing room. And the Sheik goes down the aisleway and throws fire, and it catches fire on the towel, which is just completely insane. But I want to mention a couple things. What do we have? Quadruple juice in this match? Because even Dory bled in this match, which wasn't something that was... this happened all the time. But I want to mention one thing specifically about the very, very beginning of this match. You know, I've mentioned before about the pops that certain wrestlers get when they come to the ring. And of course, you know, we've talked about Hulk Hogan. We've talked about Bruno Sammartino, Dusty Rhodes in the state of Florida. I've mentioned Chigusa Nagoya during her prime for the All Japan Women. Let's talk about how insane the Japanese fans were specifically for Terry Funk at the beginning of this match. Holy shit, Barry.
Yeah, they were nuts for him too. And as I was watching this too, you know, Terry debuted, it was 1967, if I'm correct, is when Terry made his debut. And, you know, you think of how quickly Terry Funk made an impact in professional wrestling. You know, by 71, he was already a really big deal within 4 years. And, you know, within 9 years, the guy was world's heavyweight champion at a time when the title actually meant something. But in Japan, doesn't Terry rank with Terry, Stan Hansen, Bruiser Brody, the Destroyer? Aren't they considered like the big four in Japan for American wrestlers?
They absolutely are, but I don't think that I've ever seen, you know, Stan Hansen had a certain, there was a certain attraction with the fans, and Brody and the Destroyer definitely. This was like a different level, though. I mean, this was like a hero worship. Like, there were people there that had like pom-poms, like a cheerleading squad that right. was, you know, like as he made his way to the ring. And the security that was trying to help him get to the ring was having difficulty getting him to the ring because the crowd was just smothering him. And I mean, I've seen Terry Funk matches before in Japan, but I don't know that I've ever seen a reaction like this. It was just completely insane. So we, of course, will post a link to this. And it's a crazy, crazy fun match. You get to see stuff like Abdullah taking bumps. You get to see the Sheik working his ass off. Terry and Dory, of course, one of the all-time great working teams, and they definitely show that. They're definitely in their prime right here. Really, really good stuff, Barry, and I really enjoyed this match a lot, much more than I thought I would, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, too, and it's, again, I think we all have this preconceived notion about guys like Abdullah and the Sheik, and that, you know, you're going to get 5 or 6 minutes, there's going to be blood, it's going to be a lot of gimmicks, and that's it. You know, Abdullah probably drops that elbow. That was a hell of an elbow, by the way. Probably drops that elbow a good 10 times in this match. And yeah, this is highly recommended. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah. So next, I want to ask you, Barry, something else that came to mind. You know, I was watching AEW the other night, and I was listening to Jericho do the play-by-play. And, you know, one of the things that struck me is, you know, we've talked before about how Jericho is sort of a wrestling chameleon in that he's been able to go from, you know, being a thrill seeker to being Y2J to being you're going to make the list. And now, of course, he's Le Champion. And I started thinking, other than Chris Jericho, Hulk Hogan, and the aforementioned Terry Funk, who was also a guy that changed his character many times over the years, tell me another guy that was able to recreate themselves as their career went on and stay on top. Can you think of anybody?
Oh, I'm going to have to give that one a little bit of thought.
Because, you know, you think about it, even Hogan went from being, you know, the real American to the NWO right. guy and basically recreated himself. And whether you like the guy or not, you have to give him credit for definitely being able to do that. He's another wrestling chameleon. And I think Terry's like that. And, you know, maybe that's something we'll put up on the board to see who else can think of a guy. I think it takes a really special talent to be able to do that. And I think Jericho. You definitely have to give him credit for being able to recreate himself because he's certainly, I think, the most interesting part of any AEW show at this point.
He's just so good, his commentary. And this was this past week, which was Fighter Fest, I guess the first installment of Fighter Fest. And he's just, his commentary makes everything so good. He's a heel, yes, but at the same time, he's not like this over-the-top heel. He just makes it really interesting. I enjoyed it, too. I enjoyed Fighter Fest. I did not watch. I think NXT was doing the Great American Bash, if I'm correct, and I did not watch that, but I DVR'd it. I just have to find the time. And, Jeff, I didn't watch it because, obviously, I've been watching other shows that you've recommended that we'll be discussing shortly.
Well, I certainly hope so, mister. So now, Barry, it's time to finish off our list of top 20 chain restaurants. Lou will invite you to join us again, my man. Because we are now at number 10, and number 10, Barry and Lou, Bahama Breeze Grill. Gentlemen, Barry, have you had a chance to eat at this fine establishment?
Oh, Jeff, I have eaten at Bahama Breeze many times. I was actually the original Bahama Breeze, the first location. I was there within the first week of their grand opening. It's on iDrive in Orlando. And it was really, really good when they first opened. And I still enjoy it. I should say, I don't think it's fallen the way that some of the other chains that we discussed last week. It doesn't have the same appeal that it had some 24 years ago when the first one opened up, which I believe was 96. But I do like Bahama Breeze. I think the big shock as I look at this article is there's only 37 locations. And I know at one point there was probably double that. So They've closed a lot. I know that, you know, this is, again, we're talking pre-coronavirus, which at this point, everything's off the table for that. But Bahama Breeze, what I like about Bahama Breeze, the food is good, first off. I don't think the food is bad by any stretch. I do think it's good. I like the atmosphere. It's kind of fun. If you get in there on the right night, they've got the steel drum players. It's almost like taking a mini vacation. The desserts are really good. Jeff, are you a fan of key lime pie?
Oh, absolutely.
I fucking love key lime pie, and I definitely don't eat enough.
Got to have a good crust.
Got to. That's the key. That's the key right there is the crust. And a lot of places don't. And with Bahama Breeze, they were doing this like crunchies. I forget what it was, but it was really good. They do one of the better key lime pies that I've ever had. But I do like Bahama Breeze, and I'm starving, so I'd like them a little bit more.
They do mention that this is the smallest chain that's on the list, but they do rank fifth in customer satisfaction. Lou, have you ever had a chance to go to Bahama Breeze?
Alas, no, but looking on their Wikipedia page, they're owned by the same conglomerate that also owns the Olive Garden and...
Yep, it's Darden. That's correct.
What was it, Longhorn Steakhouse? And
it's Olive Garden and Outback, if I'm correct. No, they don't own Outback. That's Landry's that owns Outback. It's Darden Restaurants who does own. It's one of the biggest in the country. They own Red Lobster. Darden actually owns Red Lobster, too.
According to Wikipedia, they owned Red Lobster until 2014. So
they sold it?
Evidently.
I can't believe they didn't email Barry.
I didn't get the memo.
What? Let's see. I'll investigate.
I know there is a Bahama Breeze that is just in the outskirts of the Sawgrass Mills Mall in South Florida. That's right. A very popular location. I went there once or twice, and I think I remember not going back because it was especially crowded, which is not shocking considering it's in the biggest mall south of Atlanta. So or right outside the biggest mall. So number nine. Now, Barry, here's one I can talk about. Maggiano's.
So I've only been to Maggiano's maybe five times. I haven't been to Maggiano's in probably 10 years, so I wouldn't be able to comment on anything recent. I will tell you, looking at the photo, that photo looks great. It looks like some roasted tomato flatbread. There's a Peroni beer. It's ice cold. It's obviously a professional photo. Maggiano's, what I liked about Maggiano's, again, surprising, only 51 locations. So I'm a little shocked. I did think it was a bigger chain than this, but I liked having the maitre d' at the front door wearing a tuxedo. I always thought that was interesting. And there was a certain theming to the restaurants. It literally was like being in Little Italy. There was
piano in the bar, that kind of thing.
Piano, yeah. It's a little dark. It's, it was almost like, it's got like an Epcot kind of feel to it, which I always thought was cool. I don't remember the food being anything, you know, to write home about. I don't remember it being terrible, but I just don't remember it being fantastic either.
I will tell you that what I do know about Maggiano's is they have some of the best Italian bread I've ever eaten in my life. My wife and I would go to Maggiano's in Boca when we lived down in South Florida, literally just to get the Italian bread. It's also, I'm a big fan of their chicken franchise, which is real good. My wife would usually get the lasagna because one of their gimmicks that they do is there are certain items on the menu that if you order it off the menu, they give you one to take home.
Oh,
and so, so you get the lasagna and then my wife would get a lasagna to, and they don't skimp on the portions either. Lou, do you have Maggiano's out in the Bay Area?
Yes, I've been to one down at this Tony upscale mall in San Jose called Santana Row. I also went to a Maggiano's Little Italy the one time I was in Philadelphia. They had a location not that far from the Reading Terminal Market. So I would echo your sentiments that it's a level above something like an Olive Garden and what I would call shitalian restaurants.
Well, two things. First of all,
that's great.
I can't believe you went to Philadelphia and didn't call Barry.
I didn't get a call or anything.
You know, that's got to be.
That was 2015. That was before y'all started this little shindig.
And the second thing is that number eight on our list is, in fact, Olive Garden. So I know Barry loves talking about the Olive Garden.
Yeah.
Yes, above Maggiano's, which is a complete.
That's a miscarriage of justice.
Yes, that's the best way to put it. I was going to use that word that Meltzer doesn't use in the Observer anymore. That begins with the letter A. But yes. Barry, let's talk about Olive Garden.
Yeah. So I think Olive Garden, I think a lot of it, if you read too, 871 locations in the U.S., that's a staggering, staggering number. That's got to be a $1 billion industry right there, just Olive Garden alone. So, you know, I get Olive Garden if you're in the middle, you're in Montana, you're in Butte, Montana, you've got an Olive Garden, that's what you got. But, you know, you come to Philadelphia, we have got these mom and pop Italian restaurants that the food is absolutely incredible. Yet you can drive by Olive Garden in Philadelphia and it's still going to be packed. And that's something I can never actually figure out. So look, I've beaten up Olive Garden and I've said my piece probably a good dozen times, Jeff, as you have as well. So I'm not going to say anything new right now, that's for sure. So I'll move right on.
Yeah, good breadsticks. I'll say that.
Okay.
and I agree with you wholeheartedly. If you're driving through Montana on some interstate and that's what's off the interstate, I wholeheartedly endorse it. But if you're in any kind of major city that has any sort of Italian population, why are you going there? I will say, if the choice is Maggiano's on one side of the street and Olive Garden on the other side of the street, the choice is pretty clear. Lou, what do you think?
Yes, it brings to mind this almost viral restaurant review of the Olive Garden back from 2012. It was this 85-year-old restaurant reviewer for the Grand Forks Herald in North Dakota. Her name was Marilyn Haggerty, and it was just a very lengthy, contemplative, and earnest review of the new Olive Garden in Grand Forks, where she concludes it with quote, "The Olive Garden is the largest and most beautiful restaurant now operating in Grand Forks. It attracts visitors from out of town as well as people who live here."
Well, we want to give a special shout out to our listeners in Grand Forks, and we hope that you're enjoying the Olive Garden.
Yeah, and I mean, hopefully it's moved up to bigger and better cities now, like Bismarck.
The jewel of the Dakotas.
Yes, indeed. It's the closest to authentic Italian in the Dakotas. So having been there, it is what it is. If I had a choice between like the Olive Garden and another chain called the Old Spaghetti Factory, I would go with Old Spaghetti Factory all day.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, Lou, mm-hmm. let me throw this at you. And I without even knowing the type of food you like, you have 45 minutes for lunch.
Yeah.
There is a Olive Garden next to a McDonald's. Which one do you choose?
If they still had all day breakfast on their menu, I'd go McDonald's for breakfast at lunch. I am all outside the lines here.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you on that, too. It's for me, getting to Olive Garden, I don't know what it would take at this point. But McDonald's, yeah, I can go to anytime.
Unless I was absolutely famished and I needed all the soup and bread sticks I could cram down my maw.
There you go.
We all have our
get vices. Them, Oz.
Yeah, Oz.
Yeah. At number seven, gentlemen, the Cheesecake Factory.
Again, Jeff, well documented that you and I are fans of the Cheesecake Factory. What I do like about the Cheesecake Factory is consistency. The fact that I don't think I've ever had a bad meal there. The service has been spotty at times, as it can be. I mean, in any restaurant, you could have an issue with service, but the food is generally consistent. Over the last month, we've actually gotten cheesecake twice in takeout and carryout. And I got to tell you, have you ever had those buffalo blasts before?
I have not.
Fucking unbelievable. So it's buffalo chicken, but it's done fried chicken style. And they take, I guess it's like an egg roll wrapper, and then they dip it in flour that's seasoned like fried chicken. So essentially, it's like you're getting a piece of fried, not a chicken finger either, a piece of fried chicken with chopped up buffalo chicken inside. It's crispy, it's salty, savory. I love it. I absolutely love them. And they do all those different types of egg rolls, and we got the avocado egg rolls, and then we got, I think, the Southwestern ones as well, which were really good. So to me, the least attractive thing about the Cheesecake Factory is the actual cheesecake. I don't know. For whatever reason, I love cheesecake, but I've had much better cheesecake at other restaurants. But I like the food, and I know you do as well.
Lou, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, there is one right near my my family's house in Marin County. And yeah, it's one of those places, the quality of food, I'd say, is good. The portions reminds me of like a, if you've ever been to the Claim Jumper, which is overcrowding your portions to the point of really assaulting you and treating you like a foie gras goose. You will eat all the food we put on your plate. My wife likes the like the ahi tuna tartare appetizer, which I would say is pretty darn good too. And their cheesecake, yeah, it's all right. I like it.
I am a fan. I've said this on more than one occasion, of their gumbo, which I think is quite excellent. Also, like the Chicken Littles and the, oh God, I can't remember what it is. It's a chicken dish where they pour it on top of mashed potatoes, and it's like chicken and vegetables. And yeah, there's probably nothing healthy about it, but it's really good. I wanted to mention before we go on the list, I posted photos over the weekend. I told Barry, haven't mentioned it to Lou yet, had a chance to go to a local establishment in the town of Ball Ground, Georgia, which maybe population, I don't know, a couple of thousand, about a 20-minute drive for my wife and I. Went to a out-of-the-way place, a Cajun place called Le Bon Temp. And my wife, this is our first socialization outside since I started my treatments. And I got to tell you, gentlemen, Mr. Rose, if you come to visit, we're taking you to Le Bon Temp, because this was seriously some of the best Cajun food I've ever had in my life. I love when you find an out-of-the-way place like that, that has food that's just out of sight. It might be like something like 12 tables in the restaurant. I had the my wife had the gumbo, the jambalaya. They had it like a platter where you get a selection of each. And the red beans and rice. I got the shrimp and grits, which was outstanding. And then I got a shrimp po' boy to go, because, you know, I'm going to get a chance to sample everything. So my wife got an extra bowl of the gumbo. I checked it out. It was worthy of the gumbo that they serve at the Cheesecake Factory. So I will give that a thumbs up. So next on our list, gentlemen.
Well, Jeff, I want to break in on this one. So it's a question for both you and Lou. You posted these photos, and I got to tell you, I love Cajun and Creole food. I think I like Creole better than Cajun, but I do like both. And sweet Lou, being in Philadelphia 5 years ago, the Reading Terminal Marketplace actually has a Cajun Creole restaurant in there.
Oh,
it's okay. In the where the main dining area is. And I totally forget the name of it, and I probably couldn't pronounce it anyways, but it's right in the main dining. The food is great. But when you posted that, Jeff, and you and I were talking about this, the first thing that came to my mind was, this might be my favorite type of food that I don't eat on a regular basis. And I say that because, other than the Reading Terminal Marketplace, I don't know if we even have a Cajun Creole restaurant in Philly or the suburbs. I'm assuming we do, but I've never heard of it. I work in the restaurant industry. So given the choice, that would be a restaurant that I would eat at like once a week. I fucking love Cajun Creole food. So I pose this question to you two guys. What is your favorite type of food that you don't eat on a regular basis, whether it's because there's nothing around you or just by choice, whatever it might be?
I would say up here now, as opposed to when we lived in South Florida, we have not found a good Cuban place up here.
There you go.
Yeah. And for me, by the way, Ball Ground, Georgia, I believe that's where they buried Kelsey's nuts. So for me, I think it would be East Coast style delicatessen. It's, you know, they have a few of those types of delis in LA, San Francisco. Really slim pickings.
So Lou, I have to interject again. You were at Reading Terminal Marketplace, which has one of the best delis in the world, which is called Herschel's. Did you go to Herschel's or no?
God, the thing is, I was in Philadelphia for essentially one day, and that one day was a Sunday. And so half of the stalls at Reading Terminal, at least, were closed. So thank goodness I at least found one stand where I got like a scrapple sandwich or something. But yeah, there are many things I have to go back and get oriented with.
So Herschel's, what Herschel's does, which makes it very unique, and the only other place that I'm aware that is doing it on the East Coast is that, which would actually be the real Katz's Deli in New York City, is they hand cut their meat. So instead of going in a slicer where every slice looks exactly alike, they actually hand cut the meat for your sandwich, which is to me. Jeff, when you were in Philly, we went to Reading Terminal with our buddy Eric Chulminski. Where did we eat? Did we eat at Herschel's?
Oh, that's a good question. And by the way, let me just say, anybody that's listening to the show, if you ever visit Philly and you don't go to Reading Terminal, you've made a mistake.
Absolutely.
I got something from, it's in the middle of the terminal, and it's like one of the, I don't know if I got a cheesesteak or something else. I mean, that would seem so, you know, routine, but I think that's what I did. I think I got a cheesesteak.
Well, their cheesesteaks are really good. You've got DeNick's there, and I think
that's what I think I got it from DeNick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So yeah, you made a good, it's a great choice though. But again, if you both ever make it back to Philly, we go and we can do multiple meals at the Reading Terminal.
I'm in favor of multiple meals. Lou, I don't know if you know, I know that too, but
yeah, usually I prefer more than a singular meal myself. Yes.
All right, let's get back to the list. Number six, the Capitol Grill. I will give a shout out to my brother, who is a humongous fan of the Capitol Grill. Barry, what do you think?
I'm a humongous fan. I interviewed with these guys, and I did not get the job. And this is going back about 10 or 11 years ago. And it was a really strict and stringent interview process I had to go through. Multiple people, at some points, groups of people interviewing me. But I, you know, this is, if you've ever gone to a Capitol Grill, I'm going to tell you, in my opinion, what I think sets Capitol Grill apart. The food is very good. The food is some of the best food I think you could ever have.
Number two in customer satisfaction.
And where I was going to go with this is the service. I think, at least in my opinion, Capitol Grill is the standard bearer. They are the league standard bearer for service. They go the distance. They do not overload their servers with a bunch of tables. You will never go into a Capitol Grill and get service like somebody out of breath, like, I'll be back in 2 minutes and I'll have your drinks or something like that. It is slow. It is paced out. It is steady. And the beauty of it is, and I say this because this was something I learned early on, Capitol Grill had a couple of policies. And one of them was, if a guest makes a reservation and they request a server by name, the server gets that table out of rotation, meaning that if everybody gets three tables, but you have somebody requesting you by name, you're going to get a fourth table. And I think they only give their servers two or three tables to begin with, but an additional table at Capitol Grill usually means an additional $50 for a server. So there is a big incentive, but they know everything about you when you walk in because they've got files on all of their diners. So they know what you like to eat, what you like to drink, you know, even if you do like a particular server, whatever it might be, they know everything about you. And to me, that really enhances the overall guest experience. And I've said it for years, I think Capitol Grill probably has the best service of any chain restaurant in the entire country. And arguably, maybe even the best service. So big thumbs up for me. It's not cheap, but it's worth it.
Lou?
There used to be a Capitol Grill in San Francisco, but alas, I didn't have a job where I could go there on an expense account. So I've never been there.
Well, like I said, my brother is a huge, huge fan. Whenever he goes, which he goes a couple times a year, he always puts it over huge. I have never been. But take the endorsement of my brother for what it's worth. And Mr. Rose, I don't think I've heard him praise a restaurant much stronger than that. So take that for what it's worth also. Number five, Seasons 52. I got to be honest with you. I've never lived somewhere where there's a Seasons 52, I don't believe, Barry.
Yeah, they were all throughout the state of Florida. It was Seasons 52 is also part of the Darden chain that we were just talking about earlier.
This number is their, one in customer satisfaction.
There you go. This is their high-end chain as well. So the food is very good here. I actually, coincidentally, 1996, I think. I forget. I lived in Orlando twice. Maybe it was 2004. I think it was 2004. And Seasons 52 at that stage was just emerging. And their first one was based out of Orlando because the company's based out of Orlando. And I was very friendly with their, I guess, their sommelier, and he had been a Disney employee for like 20 years. And through mutual friends, I knew him, but he told me about this concept of Seasons 52 and what they were going to do. And he left Disney to join the concept, which I thought was, you know, at that stage, that's kind of a big leap, you know, to be able to do something like that. When they, I will tell you a little bit of a trivia. When Seasons 52 first opened up, and I believe they've changed this policy, they discouraged having children in the restaurant. And in Orlando, I understood the logic because every restaurant in Orlando is basically geared towards families and children. So I got it. So this was supposed to be a respite from that. This is where mom and dad could go out on the weekends and they could have a nice dinner. And they didn't overtly come out and say, we don't want children. However, no high chairs, no car seats. A child must be able to sit in a seat. So kind of telling you that, you know, you either have to bring an older child or a child at two that knows how to sit in a chair and not fall off, which doesn't exist. The food is very good at Seasons 52. Everything is geared towards calories and things like that, but they use, everything's locally sourced. They use fresh ingredients. It's pretty good. I would give it a big thumbs up.
Lou, you ever been?
I have not. Just looking at their website, the closest location to me is 2 hours away in Sacramento. But looking at the concept and the menu, it looks like everything is coming off an oak-fired grill. Everything looks fresh, an extensive wine list. Damn, next time I go to Sacramento, I definitely will look this one up.
Okay. Nice. Number four, Cracker Barrel.
First off, let me say that's a horrible photo that they've put up there.
Yes, the food looks very unappetizing.
Oh, right. Good God. It looks like something that your grandma who doesn't have teeth, not yours, but anybody's grandmother who doesn't have teeth would be gumming shortly. It just looks absolutely terrible. But I like Cracker Barrel. You know, you go into a Cracker Barrel, I think you know exactly what you're going to get. Breakfast is the star here. You know, the food is good. I've gotten the country fried steak, super healthy to get that, delicious. And I got to say, I got these wild Maine blueberry pancakes there a year or two ago. Might have been the best pancakes I've ever had. So I like Cracker Barrel. You know, again, it is what it is, but I've always had a good experience there.
You know, I got to say that there's one, of course, there's one by us. And there's one by everybody, I think. I have always been a fan of their corn muffins and biscuits that they bring out with every meal. I love those, and I love to get them to go home. There is some stuff they've had that's really good. I will say, here's a very random item from their menu that I've always enjoyed every time I went there. Their green beans, obviously, they marinate them in like lard or something like that because they're the best green beans I've ever had. And I know that even though I'm eating green beans, I'm sure I'm not getting anything healthy. But you're right. Breakfast always very consistent. Dinner to me sometimes, I will say they have a very good fried chicken. Their fried chicken that they just introduced to the menu within the last year or so is really good. But there's the occasional hit or miss. But generally speaking, I've always been pretty pleased. Lou, you have to have gone to Cracker Barrel.
Yes. On that same road trip that my wife and I took, and before we got to Philly, we went to a Cracker Barrel outside of Cleveland. And this is good. I'm a sucker for a big breakfast. I'm especially a sucker for a country style breakfast.
There you go.
And getting a country style breakfast and having the opportunity to pick up a Best of Boxcar Willie 8-track cassette at the same place. You cannot beat it.
If you're looking for the greatest hits of Conway Twitty or Loretta Lynn, that is the place to go to right before breakfast, you know?
Yeah.
Did you guys ever play that game that's on every
of
table?
Course.
That where you've got to jump the pegs and all that?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. They've made a slow westward expansion. They just, maybe about a year or so ago, they opened a couple of Cracker Barrels in the Sacramento area. And people just heard the news and lost their freaking minds. There is a contingent of Cracker Barrel devotees. And, well, God love them.
Okay, so next, number three on the list, Cheddar's Kitchen. Bear?
Yeah, so I'm going to have to excuse myself. I've never eaten in a Cheddar's, but I got to tell you, I'm looking at the photo, Jeff. This photo makes me want to go to Cheddar's.
Lou, you ever been to a Cheddar's?
Alas, I have not. Once again, it is a restaurant owned by the Darden folks. Yeah, had never heard of it.
I will say then that I am the only one of the three of us that has actually been to a Cheddar's. I think my wife and I, there was one in Western Fort Lauderdale. We went to it maybe once or twice. We didn't go back, mainly having to do with the fact that there was usually an hour wait to get in there. I will say that it is listed as number 8 in customer satisfaction, number 2 in the value rank. So, I never found anything that was particularly, bad about the restaurant. Again, my issues had to do more with the fact that there was usually an hour wait to get in there. Number 2, Barry, I know this is probably, we're talking about the Darden folks again. It's Longhorn Steakhouse.
Yeah, and according to the list as well, Darden basically owns the chain restaurants in the
U.S. You know, Mr. Yeah. Darden, whoever he is rolling in the cash.
Rolling in the cash. So I'm not a fan, but that's based off of one experience that I had a year and a half ago, 2 years. I forget exactly what it's been. I will say I enjoyed the bread. I enjoyed the butter. The steak was where I had an issue. I totally forget what kind of steak I got. But it was chewy. It had the silver on it. So it was, it was like that silver vein that runs through the back of the steak. I just, for the life of me, I don't get it. But I'm clearly in the wrong on this one because you swear by it. A lot of members of our group swear by it. And obviously this list, and I trust this list actually, which has been pretty accurate. Looks like most of America really enjoys this restaurant. So I'm doing something wrong on this one, Jeff.
Okay, number 3 in the customer satisfaction, number 8 in the value rank. Before I give my thoughts, Lou, Longhorn?
It is, according to my informal unscientific survey, the number 1 place where you're most likely to get shit-faced and lose your AEW heavyweight title belt. And alas, I have not patronized one.
I will say it is described here. I think this is a good way of putting it, a casual steakhouse. Now, when my wife and I have gone, I'm a huge fan of the Wild West shrimp, which is basically a small shrimp mixed in with some peppers and stuff like that. I will say that the last time we went, right before I contracted the cancer, it was a negative experience. My steak was not very good at all, but it was the first time we've had a genuinely negative experience. Most of the times we go, the experience is relatively positive, so I give it a thumbs up. Now, Barry, it is time for number 1. Oh, boy, Mrs. Bowdern can expound on this because it's certainly one of her favorite places. It's Texas Roadhouse.
Yeah, so I've been to Texas Roadhouse numerous times, and Texas Roadhouse is the one where you can throw the peanut shells on the floor?
Exactly.
Gotcha. So I did think it was better than Longhorn Steakhouse, at least based off of the times that I had been there. Yeah, to me, they're almost interchangeable in some ways. I don't know. I guess they're better than Outback, which would be the big thing to say. Yeah, if you're looking for a value steakhouse, our options right now, I'm assuming, would be Texas Roadhouse, Longhorn Steakhouse, Outback. Are there any others at this point, or is that it? Is Sizzler still around, or are they gone?
Oh, they're still around.
Okay.
A faint pulse, but they are still around.
So, yeah, I don't know. What does Mrs. Bowdrin say, Jeff?
Well, before I go into that, Lou, what are your thoughts? Have you been to one?
There is one right near my in-laws. We went there one time. The food, I can't really recall. I had no complaints about it. The only weird thing was just all of a sudden out of the blue when all the wait staff just stops and does some like boot stomping song and dance number. And I'm like, what the fuck is this? So, yeah, I mean, that's my main memory of it.
Well, my positives on Texas Roadhouse, of course, as Barry mentioned, you basically are given a bag of peanuts and shells and you eat them and throw them on the floor. So it's like, you're making a mess and then there's just certain enjoyment in making a mess. They have their hamburgers decent. They have a good chili, I will say, on their appetizer. Their chili is very good. But my wife's primary reason for going, she loves the honey rolls that they bring with it's like a cinnamon butter. And Mrs. Bowdrin can't get enough of that. And when we go, it's usually because of that. I got to be honest with you. I'll get a hamburger and the Texas chili. There's not a lot on the menu that I find extremely great. If I go, I'm usually taking one for the team, and Mrs. Bowdrin wants to go. So anyway, so that's number one, Texas Roadhouse. We will post a link to the article so you folks on our Facebook group, Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry, can give your thoughts as to what you think. As we start turning the final poll there, going for the heading for the final poll, Barry, let's talk very quickly. We're not going to turn this into an Unsolved Mysteries episode, but we had a chance to watch the first couple episodes of the Netflix series, which is, you know, they've restarted the Unsolved Mysteries show. You had a chance to watch the first two, Barry. What'd you think so far?
So I enjoyed both, and I actually watched them last night. I enjoyed both. I question why call it Unsolved Mysteries, because it bears no resemblance to the show prior, except for the theme song, which has been reworked and retooled a little bit. But one thing I really enjoyed about the show, and I think this was actually a really smart move, there's no host. There's nobody doing commentary throughout it. So there's no Robert Stack. And it reminds me of...
Did you happen to catch, Barry, in the introduction of the show, as they're doing the famous theme song or the reworking of the theme song, right before they cut to the stories, there's an image of Robert Stack.
Yes. Yes.
You did see that. Okay. Yeah. So it's like a little tribute to Robert Stack.
Yeah. Which I think is great, actually.
Yes, absolutely.
I think because we all associate Robert Stack with Unsolved Mysteries. But I like the reworking of the theme song. I like the fact that there's not a host. And the show is very similar to a show like on CBS, like 48 Hours or one of those shows. But you have taken out the annoying co-host or the annoying guy doing the voiceovers, which I thought was great. So the two shows that we watched, the first
one was on a gentleman in the Baltimore area that disappeared. His name was Ray Rivera. What did you think of that episode?
So I'm going to break kayfabe on this one, Jeff. And I had no idea this was going to happen. As I'm watching the show, his brother comes on screen and I'm friendly with his brother.
No kidding. Wow.
So and I got to say, I was going to surprise you. And of course, I did everything within my power to try to get him to be on the show today. Angel Rivera. And I'll tell you how I know him. Angel Rivera has been one of the members of the Monsters in the Morning Orlando radio show for the last 5 or 6 years. And because I've got a friend that's actually on that show, somebody I'm really friendly with, I reached out to Angel a few years ago. We're Facebook friends. I've invited him to actually a couple of the fan fests. He's never come. But as I'm watching it, I was like, holy fuck, that's Angel on the television. So late last night, I sent him a message. I reached out to him, and he never responded. He hasn't seen it, but I know that he does a lot of DJing and shit. So I was really surprised to see him on there. I think as we're watching this, and I get the feeling with both the episodes, especially this one, it's very clear who's responsible for his death. There's just not enough proof right there to come forth and to convict somebody or to even charge somebody with it. But in my mind, it was very, you know, I don't want to spoil this for anybody, but it's very obvious who's responsible. And it's very sad because it looks like Ray was involved with something that was maybe a little over his head. It had to do with his employment, but he really seemed like a really nice guy. And I got to tell you, Angel, my interactions with him, really, really genuinely a nice guy.
Well, I'll tell you what, Barry, before we go on, let me just give, for those who haven't seen it yet, let me just give a quick outline to the story. So what we have here is a guy who's been married, I want to say 2 years, beautiful wife. They live in the suburbs of Baltimore. He works for a company that deals with finance or financials or something like that. He writes a financial newsletter for them. And his wife goes out of town on a business trip. A friend of hers, business friend, is staying with them, and her husband is in his office doing some work. The friend says that she hears the husband get a phone call and sort of rush out of the house. You know, six o'clock at night, you know, nothing. I don't think it was like in the middle of the night or anything like that. So what happens is the guy is disappears off the face of the earth. Basically, there's no sign of him. And then I want to say, what was it? About a week maybe goes by or something like that. They're doing a search. They find the guy's car down by this hotel, which is apparently a pretty famous hotel in Baltimore.
The Belvedere.
The Belvedere, thank you. And they're doing a search, at which point they go up to a conference room that is near the top floor of the hotel. And because I believe maybe someone saw a hole in the roof or something like that.
Yep.
And they find the body of Ray Rivera. But when they start doing the basic geometric figures as to how he could have got there from different parts of the roof, it basically is like, yeah, no, I don't see the guy running. I don't see the guy from this angle dropping. There's just like a weird mystery to that. It's like the guy was dropped out of a helicopter, essentially. And one of the things I mentioned to Barry before he started watching it, so I'm curious as a reaction, I'm going to ask you now. It's in a lot of ways similar to the mystery that we talked about Christine Lamb, the girl that ended up in the water tower on the hotel in Los Angeles. And it's like, how the F did she get there? So, you know, Barry, so what do you think? How did he get there?
He was, well, if you, so I really was intent on watching this too, because he went straight down. He went vertical instead of horizontal. So he was almost like a missile, because when you look at the hole, yeah, the hole was, you know, I don't know, 3 feet by 3 feet max. So he couldn't have gone horizontal. But without giving away too much, when the autopsy came back, the medical examiner wouldn't sign off on this being a suicide. And I should say the police were trying to position this like it had been a suicide, and they were insistent that this was a suicide. However, the medical examiner, which is really where the police get most of their information from, said, yeah, there's some injuries here that are not consistent with this fall. And there were two, which I believe it was two leg breaks, the tibia.
To the shin, I think, I thought.
Yes. And the medical examiner basically said, this is not consistent with this fall in any form. So you were right, though. He was there for, I think, 7 or 8 days. And they did an interview with the guy who found him. And he said that that's an image he'll never get out. He could smell the death. But it was very sad. It was very sad. And what I got from it, very sad, because his wife, deeply in love with him, even to this day, it just seems like, you know, some 15 years later, like she's still just really broken up 15 years later, and she hasn't fully recovered. And the other aspect was, it did appear that the police, for whatever the reasoning is with this, just want to classify this as a suicide, and they want everybody to move on. And, you know, again, if the medical examiner is insistent and the family's insistent that this guy wasn't suicidal, there were none of the markers there that would claim that this was a suicide. And then the cop, the initial cop, the private investigator who was on the case said, there's not one single marker to this case, which is should be suggesting that this guy was going to be suicidal in any form. And then you know, again, I don't want to spoil too much, but the fact that the people that he worked for, some of their actions post haste after the death, I mean, that just says a lot right there in my eyes. So this was a little stunning.
There is one aspect of the case and one person in the case where 20 minutes into the episode, you find yourself saying, well, why hasn't this person come on there and spoken yet? And as the show goes on, it becomes more and more glaring that this person has not been interviewed and is not taking part in the show. And then towards the end, you find out what happened, or, you know, at least there's an explanation as to why that person hasn't done it. But it was definitely an interesting show. And again, as Barry said, the way this guy ended up there, it's definitely at very best odd. So then, Barry, the second episode involved a woman named Patrice Andres. Now, here's what's really interesting, Barry. I get a text from my friend Pat, who lives in Florida, and she goes, have you had a chance to watch the Unsolved Mysteries show yet? And I said, no, as a matter of fact, Kim and I are planning on watching it tonight. And she says, well, it's really interesting that the second episode involves a woman from Cumming, Georgia. So I was, you know, I did the Barry Rose, what? And sure enough, the second episode in the series involves a woman in the town that I live in. And this happened approximately 15 years ago. We have a woman, Barry, just to give a quick outline of the story. Woman works as a hairdresser. She has her own business. She has a young son who
Pistol.
I want to. Yeah,
guy's
yeah,
name is Pistol.
Yeah, the kid's name is Pistol. That's just
Pistol
an interesting.
Black.
And she is raising her son. She is married to a man who's approximately 20 years older than her, who in his own right is an interesting character, Barry. I think we can agree with that. And so anyway, this woman's at her beauty salon approximately 11:30 on a weekday. And people are driving by. They notice because she has a an SUV or a pickup or something like that, that she backs into the parking spot every day. People notice that the pickup truck or the SUV is now positioned where it looked like maybe she gave somebody a jump, like their battery had died or something like that. And anyway, the woman ends up, someone tries to call for an appointment and there's no answer. So they go there. The shop is empty, which they said is very unusual for her. There was some money that was taken out of the register. But the woman essentially disappears for the better part of over a year and a half, at which point, and this is another interesting part, they find a church in Dawsonville, which is the town where our pharmacy is, Barry, on the sort of the backyard of the church. They're doing some work because they're, I don't know if they're building an addition or they're doing some work back there. And they find the remains of this woman some year and a half after she had disappeared. Now, Barry, I will just stop at this point and say, while you talk about what you thought of the episode, there are some pretty odd things that go on regarding her family, though.
Yeah, definitely. So first question, Jeff, have you driven by the hair?
No.
It looks like it's still there, right?
The building that was her beauty salon?
Yeah.
It certainly gave the impression when they were taping the episode, yeah.
Yeah, definitely did. I thought that was interesting. So as I was watching it, there was a couple of things that really struck out. One was how bad I felt for Pistol, the son, who's now got to be in his early to mid 30s. Clearly, he has had a fucked up life since his mother died. And it's, you could see it. And when he talks, he's got this pained way, this pained cadence of speaking that I felt. And I started researching him online afterwards just to see how fucked up his life was. And it's fucked up. And I really felt for him because his mother, who was really the guiding force in his life, was just ripped away. And he clearly loved her to death. He just loved her. And you could see it. And you could just see how much pain this kid is in. Even some 16, 17, 18 years later, whatever it's been now. So I really felt for him. The other thing that really got to me was what a steaming pile of shit his stepfather was, to the point of, I'm going to say this out, if there has ever been somebody that is guilty of something, this is the guy. Because when he's talking, he's shaking at times. His movements to the camera just scream guilt. And as the story goes, apparently she was going to ask for a divorce. He apparently was a real fucking piece of shit to the kid. And the kid said the first year he was great. And by the second year, he completely treated me terrible. But when you watch him speak, you just know he's up to something here. You know something took place. But the real key to this whole thing for me, Jeff, was what he did to Pistol. Pistol being 15 or 16 years old when this happened, Pistol comes home 24 hours later after his mother is gone and all the locks are changed and the stepfather has basically changed the locks and will not allow him in the house. He would have never done that thinking that the woman was still alive, his wife was still alive. He would have only done that knowing that she is not going to be returning. That's why, in my opinion, this guy is super fucking guilty.
Yeah. Well, not only that, he wouldn't let the kid get any of his clothes.
Yes.
You know, or any of his personal items or anything like that. It was just basically, you don't live here anymore. Yeah, I know your mom is gone and we don't know where she is. But let's get into some of the other twisted aspects of the story. When they find the woman's remains, okay, the guy has the funeral that, you know, they bring the remains of the woman to the funeral home. And they actually talk to the funeral director about this. The husband, who, as I said, at about 20 years older than the woman, seemed to be a bit of a control freak. Would that be fair, Barry?
And was stated as such by her best friends. Yes.
And so, but he had the funeral director in the funeral home lay out her bones like the skeleton remains, like, you know, here's the arm. Here are the legs. Here's where the torso was or whatever, and the skull. So he could spend some time with her bones.
Yep.
It was just beyond the creepiest fucking thing you'll ever hear in your life. He then has the body cremated. he still, 16 years later, has her remains. He kept it in the top of the closet, which, you know, I get some people can't let go. And you know, they I don't know. I personally wouldn't have done that. But, you know, I'm not going to judge the guy hugely for keeping the remains. But when he starts telling the story about how he would sleep with the cremated remains, Barry, again, things that make you go, this guy is just a little beyond the odd phase.
Jeff, not to interrupt, but he said, so I watched this last night, and then immediately I went back to the beginning and I rewatched it. Jeff, he said he likes to snuggle with the cremated remains. He used the word snuggle. Holy fucking shit, right?
Yeah. Exactly. So much troubling about here in my hometown. I felt like going, thanks a lot, because now people have an idea of what Cumming, Georgia is like.
So how many people live in Cumming, Georgia? Like
I mean, it's not like, you know, like a one stoplight town.
Okay.
You know, I mean, it's a small suburban town outside of Atlanta. You know,
you've got to let us know if you ever run into some of these people, if you ever run into Pistol or the ex-husband, Rob, I think was his name. Yeah.
It's definitely at the very best, it's extremely odd.
Yeah. At the very best.
But I will say, I recommend, if you get a chance to watch on Netflix, my wife and I actually watched episodes 3, 4, and 5. Oh my God, Barry, episode 3 is just beyond freaking weird when you get to that one. But we will finish up over the weekend before when this episode drops. I will have checked back into the hospital for my 6th and final series of treatments. So I would encourage you to watch it. It's a nice little homage to the original Unsolved Mysteries television show.
So, Jeff, tonight I am watching on – do you ever watch Svengoolie? I know you watch MeTV.
Yeah, yes. I know what you're talking about. What's he doing tonight?
Tonight is Billy the Kid versus Dracula, which
John Carradine's in that, isn't he?
John Carradine, that's right. So I am going to watch that. But immediately following at 10 o'clock, Jeff, am I going to Netflix and watching Unsolved Mysteries, or am I heading to HBO and watching Ford versus Ferrari?
That's a tough call. You really can't go wrong. Just because I will say between episodes 3 and 5, episode 3 is the strongest of the episodes.
Okay.
So I'll just throw that out there. Lastly, I know this is going to be a day late and a dollar short, but here's something that really irritates me. And I don't know if Barry feels this way as a dog owner. Our friend Chris Spiker says, you know, it's just not a Breaking Kayfabe with Bowden and Barry episode unless someone goes on a rant. Yeah. We're at the 4th of July weekend, folks. And as a proud dog owner, let me just say, folks, if you go to a park or some place where they're doing, you know, like a citywide fireworks episode or something like that, that's fine. You know, the city's putting it on. It's very organized, very professionally done. But if you're one of these fucking assholes in the middle of a neighborhood that decides that you need to shoot off fireworks, or you need to, you know, let off the firecrackers or the M80s or whatever it is, you know, especially if you do it on a night leading up to the 4th of July, somehow you feel at 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night, you need to let the neighborhood know that you've got your supply of fireworks. Fuck you. Because you know what? My wife and I are having to give medication to our dogs tonight. You know, a little doggy downer, because they both freak out at the fireworks. I don't know. Does Ozzy do that, Bear?
He doesn't. And I got to say, nothing ever bothers Ozzy, but there are so many dogs in my neighborhood that the owners tonight, and my next door neighbor, I shouldn't say my next door, but in my cul-de-sac, she actually has to leave our neighborhood to go to her son's house to put her dogs there because it's very quiet. But so many dogs that they're getting sedatives tonight because they're freaked out. I do see both sides of it. It is July the 4th. People want to shoot off fireworks.
July 4th, not July 2nd or 3rd.
Well, and that's a great point, because in my neighborhood, and maybe yours as well, there are certain people in this neighborhood that have been doing fireworks the last 5 and 6 days, which makes zero sense. But the one that really irritates me, and this person is generally selfish, there is a neighbor of mine. He is in his late 60s, and he's been shooting off bottle rockets all week. This is a man who could be collecting Social Security. and he's fucking shooting off fireworks. And there's no regard. Like, I found fucking rockets everywhere in pieces. We all know when you do this in a residential area, first off, you could cause damage. You could cause a fire. Something could happen. So at least be smart and don't do it on people's property. I'm getting pulling shit off of my property, which I shouldn't have to do. The other aspect is have consideration, whether it's a dog, whether it's property, whether it's somebody's child, whatever it is. I get it. It's 4th of July. I get fireworks are going to take place, and they should. At the same time, just have some consideration and some common fucking sense.
Yes. And as I said, if you, you know, go to some city or county a fireworks display, I have no problem with that at all. That's why it's there. And it's being handled by professionals. You know, I don't know if you saw Barry, my wife posted.
I loved it. Yes, I did. I
my wife posted that every single 4th of July. Shout out to the people that are going to be losing one of their fingers this weekend. So Barry, it'll be a damn shame if your neighbor with the bottle rockets is one of those people that ends up going to someone like my wife to figure out how to use their fucking hand because they blew their fingers off. So on that, Lou got a laugh out of that. I appreciate it. So anyway, on that note, on behalf of our producer, sweet Lou Kippelman out in the Bay Area, thank you for all you do, sweet Lou. And my co-host, Barry Rose, they call me the Booker. And for episode 144, we will talk to you folks next week.